Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Nice to be here. Nice to see you all. Tim described our ascension practice as a mandala yesterday, and this little orchestration that just happened was a good manifestation of that, wasn't it? So many people doing different things, but I was up there bowing, and then I came over here, and Fred brought the lectern, and Hannah had brought my seat, and Carrie brought the tea, and I sat down, and it all worked out. So we have this model where we are all part of a working whole, and no one part is more important than the other, and we can't do it by ourselves. And yet, we also have this myth of this story of Shakyamuni under the Bodhi tree that seems to be a pretty heroic story, a pretty heroic feat of individual achievement. And these two things are present in our practice and I think worth looking at. And one of the reasons we're working with the teaching of great faith, great doubt, and great determination is because I think it illustrates these two aspects and how sometimes one is emphasized and sometimes the other. So just to refresh our memory from the article, a talk by Cohen Yamada, get us right into the spirit of things. When the great root of faith and the great ball of doubt are present, great determination will arise. Great determination is a strong resolve that wells up from the bottom of our gut and spurs us on. We already believe that we ourselves are intrinsically awake. We only need to discover what is within us. We ask ourselves, why can't we realize it? It must be possible. With great determination, we continue to practice Mu single-mindedly, but mountains of silver and walls of iron rise up before us and we can't break through. Still, we must continue to goad ourselves on. There is no reason I can't do what others have done. And then you will know yourself for yourself only. Mu will suddenly break open, astonish the heavens, and shake the earth. So taken as a single passage, that's a pretty heroic description of our practice, right? And I think we all have a little bit of a reaction to that. And it's fun to talk about Rinzai and Soto. Sometimes I think that the way we describe Rinzai, we put all of our bad habits in our shadow and stuff and say, that's what Rinzai does. And then they do it to us. Oh, Soto, they're just sitting around. So I want us to acknowledge that we have this, we have it all in our own minds and our own frame of reference. And I think we do carry this heroic vision of practice, despite many diligent efforts to dispel it. And as we're saying in this teaching, all three of these things are somehow necessary ingredients of a practice that unfolds, that ripens. Great faith, great doubt, and great determination. So how do these things go together? How do we find our way? Both of these visions, the relational mandala ecosystem vision and the single heroic effort vision, are present in both traditions, I think, and both are in this teaching, this talk by Cohen Yamada. In fact, as part of his description of great faith, he says, It includes trusting that if we ask for help from the three treasures, we will definitely get it. So this asking for help is kind of not so much the heroic part of it, it seems to me. It's asking for help, being willing to ask for help and getting it. The universe responding. So this mutually assisting, mutually responsive universe is a big teachings of Dogen's. If we let go, we will be embraced. Call and response arise together. And that's an element of our faith, is this willingness to let go and know that somehow it will be all right. But when I read some of these things about breakthrough and being prodded by this great ball of doubt, having, I guess, tried that long enough, I have a somewhat visceral reaction. And it seems to me that if we make this practice about achieving, then we just become consummate achievers and we haven't really gotten anywhere. And again, these are my shadow sides that are coming out, my bad habits that are being reflected here. But I do think we need to really develop that other side. Even in the story of Shakyamuni's enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, certainly both elements are there, and it depends a little bit on how the story is told. We know the story of Buddha sitting upright under the tree, being assailed by doubts and fears produced by Mara, and all the arrows come flying towards Buddha and they turn to flowers because of this aura of presence that he has. And Mara is eventually vanquished. And yet that the last thing that happens there before Mara is vanquished, so-called, is that Buddha has a moment of maybe doubt, maybe incompleteness, whatever that might be. Some stories say he thought he wasn't good enough. And Mara presented him with the question, what makes you think you can be this heroic figure? You can't do that. And he touches the earth, and the earth rumbles and says, yes, Shakyamuni Buddha, you can be a hero. You're the hero. Yes, and Mara is vanquished. So that's kind of the heroic side of it. But a slightly different telling of it is Buddha finally arrives at the realization that he can't do it alone. And he touches the earth, and the earth bears witness to this mandala, this interconnection, and says, Buddha, you are not separate, and thus enlightenment awakens. So those are two different things, and I think it makes sense to pay attention, and I really prefer the second one, I have to tell you. We've been working, I've been working in the Home Sangha the last week or so with a fragment of a Rumi poem. It goes like this. God created the child, that is, your wanting, so that it might cry out, so that milk might come. Cry out. Don't be stolid and silent with your pain. Lament and let the milk of loving flow into you. So this is much different, right? This is surrendering to this cry of want and voicing that. And in doing that, the universe responds. The milk of loving flows, and connection happens. So this is about more about surrender than heroic victory. A little bit more on that topic. The Zen teacher tends to be sometimes portrayed in heroic terms, and I think Dharma talks can be exercises in heroic accomplishment sometimes. Like, if I can just say the right thing in the right way, the sky will split open and everyone in the room will be enlightened. And even though, of course, I would never admit to having such thoughts, they're in the background somehow because of this mythology, I think. And I don't know what to do about it. Anyway, the way these talks develop, particularly when Tim and I are alternating, at least for me, is that I don't really get too far along on my talk until after Tim gives his talk, and then things start percolating and I start trying to piece things together, knowing that already there are things I want to say, but seeing how it might fit together. And so I had such a construction going in my head. As I was leaving Linda's house this morning, Linda Moritz, where I'm staying. So I was driving away in the dark and the frost, and I saw this flicker of movement off to the right, wondering what kind of creature it might be. And sure enough, it was a deer standing right there by the side of the road in this sort of glittery, frosty world. And it decided to walk across in front of me. So, well, of course, I had to slow way down and pay attention. And it turns out that this deer was missing a foot. It had four legs, but one of the legs was missing a foot, you know, the dark hoof part. And I don't know if maybe this deer is a familiar resident of the neighborhood, but it was very, it wasn't moving comfortably. My son in his household has a three-legged cat that just scampers all around. You know, you think, why would it need a fourth leg? But this deer was even, you know, trying to, wanting to place the foot on the pavement, but not doing it because it seemed that that black part, that hoof, was missing. And so it went very slowly across my path in this, in my headlights and the glittering frost. And of course it looked toward me or toward the headlights. And I didn't know what to do. I don't know what to do with that. I don't know what to make of it. All I can say is, oh, and where is my heroic talk now? It's just like, this is wordless. This is a cry of need. This is somehow a reaching out that grabs me, and yet I don't really know what to do. I could try to find a number for animal rescue, but I could have, but I didn't. And so I was very humbled by this sort of seemingly direct appeal to my heart that left me speechless and without knowing what to do, really. And so this heroic, all these ideas in my head kind of, like, okay, how can I possibly say the right words and enlighten the whole sky in the room today? It doesn't look like it's going to happen. Luckily we got rid of that, at least for a while. And made room for something else, perhaps, to take its place. So continuing to look at this topic of great faith, great doubt, great determination. Part of great faith, as Tim was explaining yesterday, is faith that we are already awakened, we are already Buddha, we inhabit Buddha nature, we're somehow, we're right there, it's already there. And yet, we can easily get sidetracked, I think, in this great faith, and we can start to think there is this pure Buddha nature and there's this other stuff. So for this talk, I dipped into Not Always So, this book of Suzuki Roshi's teachings that I don't get to very often, but it is a treasure and a treasury of teachings. So he talks a little bit about Buddha nature, and I'm quoting from a segment called Jumping Off the 100-Foot Pole, which is another expression, of course, of our, another expression in our teaching of this great faith, great determination, great doubt, great energy, somehow coming together. But speaking of Buddha nature, Suzuki Roshi says, evil desires is another name for Buddha nature. Evil desires is just a name we use, but there is no such thing we can separate out and throw away. So he's admonishing us to, of course, not think that Buddha nature is one thing and evil desires are another. Not think that we are at war with delusion and are going to vanquish it and step into the world of enlightenment. As it sort of sounds from these stories and from these other descriptions of practice. And he goes on to say, the Buddha nature which you think you have within yourself is not Buddha nature. So I think that bears repeating. The Buddha nature which you think you have within yourself is not Buddha nature. When you become you yourself, or when you forget all about yourself and say, yes, that is Buddha nature. So there is a, you know, this is what there's, this is kind of our version of great doubt or something. There's, yes, there's this beautiful teaching that Buddha nature is there. Nothing is separate from it. And yet when we think we possess it, when we think Buddha nature is inside of us, then we miss it. That's not Buddha nature. Of course, it is Buddha nature, but it's not what we're talking about. And so there is something to be done here, right? Something to be, something to motivate us to practice. Some version of great doubt, some version of great determination, where we say yes to practice, yes to our life. My first teacher, Dosho Port, when I asked him about this teaching of, I said, why do they use the word great doubt? I mean, it sounds like energy and determination and drive, and why would you use the word doubt? And he said, well, you don't rest until you have verified it for yourself. So we have faith that we have, that we are Buddha nature, and we have to, the words get us into trouble. But we can't just sit there in that belief. There is, we do need to ripen that and to allow it to come forward. So whether that's verifying it for yourself, that could be a little heroic, but there is something to be done, right? So going back to Koan Yamada, he says, to meet the true Buddha within us, we must be ready to give up our lives. And we've heard that before, right? And that's, it's always a little disturbing when somebody says something like that. And jumping off the 100-foot pole can sound like that, you know, giving up our lives. So I don't think giving up our life is necessary, but in a way, I would rather say giving up our existence is necessary. So does that sound any better? Giving up our existence, giving up our experience of separateness and existing separately. Perhaps we can give that up. So I've been working with that the last 24 hours. And I've long thought that despite our beautiful teachings of dependent origination, for instance, of how nothing can exist separately from anything else, how this is because that was, how this thing, this self, contains nothing but non-self components, that this thing or this self is totally dependent on all the causes and conditions that have come together to bring it to this moment. So this is a beautiful, kind of theoretical description of how things cannot exist separately. And yet, I think, you know, that just goes in one ear and out the other, I think. We, you know, we fervently adhere to this highly improbable sense of independent existence. And this is how I think of it. And examine your own mind. I mean, so set aside what you know and all the beautiful ideas of interconnectedness that are nice to have. But what is the experience of walking around in this world? And I think it is something has arrived, and here we're talking about both things and selves. Something has arrived from nowhere. It just appeared. Here it is. And it exists in time without essentially changing at all, because it is the thing, and then somehow it disappears into nothingness. So that's my description of how I think we operate in the world. We operate as if the solid thing came out of nothing, and here it is to be used, to be interacted with, to be connected with or not, and then at some point it will disappear into nothingness. And here is this self. I'm here. I'm moving through the world. My clothes change. I acquire some memories, but nothing. It's really just an abiding thing that came from apparently nothing and apparently will just disappear into nothing. So maybe it's just me, but see if that describes at all your experience of walking through the world and how you meet the things of your life, how self and other interact in your normal walking around. So when I said we could, I thought we could surrender our existence. I'm ready to surrender that sense of abiding separateness, right? I can feel that prison. I can feel that suffering when I inhabit that role. Suzuki Roshi gives us a little encouragement, I think, a little guidance when he says, be yourself in the present moment, always yourself, without sticking to an old self. So this is a loosening up of what I was talking about, right? We be ourself, inhabit ourself, but don't stick to that self that was just here. Let me read a little bit more of that. So the secret is to just to say yes and jump off from here. Then there's no problem. It means to be yourself in the present moment, always yourself, without sticking to an old self. You forget all about yourself and are refreshed. You are a new self. And before that self becomes an old self, you say yes, and you walk into the kitchen for breakfast. Or you step off the pole, you're into the next moment. So the point on each moment is to forget the point and extend your practice. So in a way, we're saying yes to the next self, right? Yes, just be this self. Yes. Now I'm the self giving the talk. Later I'll be the self who is sitting with his legs hurting or whatever. Later I'll be the self who goes home to my wife. Later I'll be the self who is really just bacteria in the overall ecosystem. But essential, of course. But so I've been experimenting with this sense of just inhabiting the self of the moment. And as I contemplate retirement from my current mode of being a teacher, it's like something will have to be shed. And so that self will no longer be there for me to inhabit. So how can I inhabit this self and not get stuck to that old one, not bring that old one along with me? And so this is one of our fundamental teachings, right? Our teaching of we are reborn in each moment. And it's liberating. And the closer we look, I think, to how we inhabit and cling to this self, this role, this suit of clothes, the easier it is to say yes to the next one. Yes. Yes. But as I was working with this in my own mind, I came to a point where I was ready to give away everything, all of my incarnations, and ready to just go into the next moment. But there was this sense of me continuing that I wasn't ready to give up. It's like the sense of becoming a different self. There's a twist there. Right? Like if I could inhabit the same body and all the same memories, but I would just be a different self. I'm wanting for continuation there. So we talk about this practice as being transformative, and right? We're all into that. We're all ready to be transformed. But really? But you want to be, we want to be that same self with a new suit of clothes or shining brightly for all to see. But somehow we want that continuity, right? We don't want somebody else to get to be that transformed person. I mean, how unfair would that be? We did all the work, right? So there's this wanting for continuation, if you will. And I got to a point this morning where I saw that I had been thinking I needed to surrender this wanting. I needed to surrender it. And I couldn't, because it was just there, it seemed to be. Inescapable. And it seemed, isn't that the... how could I? Don't I have to let go of that, go beyond it? And then I thought, well... in the spirit of the Rumi poem and in the spirit of not being able to do it myself, in the spirit of not trying to be heroic about it, it seems like I could just surrender to that wanting. That wanting was Buddha nature. That wanting was delusion. And delusion was Buddha nature. And so surrendering to this self that won't let go, you know, including that in the to which we surrender to. So I had been thinking, I need to surrender my existence, but I came to, I need to surrender to my existence. And then the embrace, something happens, right? If I don't fight it, then something happens. So we've been working with radical acceptance this fall, and there's a lot of... we do a lot of arguing with the teaching like that. Well, all teachings, we are always arguing with teachings, I think. But I've come to this sense of surrendering, and so not surrendering life, but surrendering to life. Here I am, wanting, and that wanting animates the heart of the world. That wanting cries out for a response and is its own response. That wanting is no other than the deer walking across in front of me. And I told myself to jump, but I couldn't jump. So I surrendered to not being able to jump. And the pole disappeared, and I was held. Who knows how long that will last? Anyway, thank you for listening, and I think we can surrender in a way that says yes. I think saying yes is a great practice. And we're not surrendering to the things that are oppressing us. We're not surrendering to people, to institutions, to injustice. We are surrendering to our life. We're surrendering to our existence and saying,